Good day, welcome to the Drinker, Biddle, and Reese LLP Inside the Beltway conference call. And at this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Fred Riesch. Please go ahead, sir.
Well, thank you very much, Eduardo, and hello, everybody. This is the 31st of our quarterly calls, so we're getting close to 8 years of making these calls. And I thank you, and I thank Matt Kitsis for all of the support. By the way, there were over 1,100 people registered for the call today, which to me indicates a huge interest in what's going on at the SEC, at FINRA, and with the SECURE Act. So I hope we're able to meet your needs. It's a big topic, and we'll be talking about it each quarter for a little while now. So if we don't get to what you are interested in today, then we will get there. Just give us time. As Eduardo said, the session is being recorded, and we will, in 3 or 4 days, post it on our website. One of the interesting things about our website 3 or 4 days from now is that the Drinker Biddle will become Fagree, Drinker, Biddle, and Reese. In other words, on Saturday, there's a merger of a 700-attorney law firm and a 600-attorney law firm, so on our next call, we'll be representing 1,300 attorneys. It's a big deal around here, and I hope it is valuable ultimately to you all as well. The people on the call with me today, most of them, if you've listened before, you're going to know. But let me start with myself. I'm Fred Riesch. I'm a partner in the firm. I'm chair of the Financial Services ERISA team. With me is Brad Campbell, and Brad has been with me since the beginning. Brad's also a partner in the firm. I'm in Los Angeles. Brad's in Washington, D.C. Importantly, Brad is a former assistant secretary at the Department of Labor that governs the areas that we're talking about. His whole group is going to be writing the regulations on several of the things that we'll talk about today. Also with me is Sandy Granham, another partner in the firm. Sandy's in our Florham Park in New York offices. She heads up our FINRA group and does both compliance and arbitration litigation work, controversy work. And then finally, from the Drinker Biddle side of things, Jim Lundy. Jim, for many years, was an attorney with the SEC. He's now a partner in the firm. Jim and I work closely on SEC examinations of our clients and on compliance programs for our clients. So we've got a good group of people to talk about the subjects you're interested in. Also with me is Jim Dolan, who's the Vice President of Retirement Strategies at NetTixus Investment Managers. Jim has been a great supporter of these programs and a friend, and we really, really appreciate your support, Jim. Tell us a little bit about what you're up to.
Happy to, Fred. Thanks so much, and thank you to everyone who's called in today. 1,100 registrants, that's fantastic. I certainly can't believe that we're almost closing in on 10 years of this call. I certainly think it's helpful information. As Fred said, my name's Jim Dolan. I'm responsible for the strategic relationships at NetTixus Investment Managers and our defined contribution business. For those of you who aren't familiar with NetTixus, we have over 20 investment strategies globally. It's a broad platform of independent managers. In my business, we focus on our sustainable investment options. We have the industry's only sustainable target date strategy, and some of our affiliates that you might be familiar with are Luma Sales, Harris Associates, the Oakmark Funds, and Morova, which is our sustainable investment manager. That's a little bit about NetTixus, and again, I want to thank Drinker Biddle and thank Fred for the partnership over the years, and with that, we'll get right into the call. Thanks, Fred.
Hey, John, thank you so much, and I got so excited about the merger with the Fagree firm that I forgot to tell you that. But you can still go, wait for about 4 or 5 days, maybe business days. You can still go to www.drinkerbiddle.com, and you'll get redirected to a tab like Insights and Events where you can find the recording. Better than that, though, we're actually going to email, for everybody who registered for the conference, we'll email you a link to the recording once it's up there. Feel free to share it with your compatriots, your friends at work, people who might be interested in this. This is designed to be a benefit to the retirement community. It's not meant to be explicit. So any way you can update the message out there would be great. Having said that, let's turn to the SECURE Act. We'll jump right into it. And Brad, let me you know, most of our work, Brad, is at more at the institutional level than the individual level. That is, we represent plans and plan service providers more than individual investors. Others in our firm do that. But looking at the SECURE Act from an institutional, sort of a retirement plan, service provider, plan sponsor perspective, what leaps off the page at you from the SECURE Act?
Well, thanks, Fred, and thanks, everybody, for taking the time to join us. As you say, Fred, there's a lot in the SECURE Act, and some of it is more institutionally focused and more sort of at the plan level, let us say, and others parts are really more kind of individually focused. So as you say, I thought we'd start today by really looking at a couple of the big issues that are going to be affecting plans and service providers to plans. And kind of the categories I want to start with are, of course, the new PEPs, pooled employer plans, which is, for those of you who have been following this for a while, the sort of final name for what a lot of people for a long time have been referring to as open MEPs, and also look at some of the provisions in there regarding lifetime income that are some fairly significant changes that are going to offer opportunities and issues for plans to think about. So first of all, let's start with PEPs, pooled employer plans, PEPs. So as you all remember, for a while, there's been a desire to have a way for unrelated small employers, doesn't have to be small employers, but for unrelated employers, typically thinking of smaller employers, to be able to join together to offer plans, one plan, instead of having, you know, 50 small employers with 50 plans with one administration scheme, to instead have one plan which has 50 participating employers with one audit, one Form 5500, et cetera. And there's been a lot of discussion about this over the years. The Department of Labor's previous guidance on this, advisory opinions, et cetera, basically said you had to have a real common nexus between those members and those participating employers to be able to have the one plan structure. And it was very difficult to get that in many cases. There were a lot of requirements. As you all probably remember, last fall, the Labor Department put out a regulation to create association retirement plans, which was more open, but still had a lot of restrictions on how those groups could be organized. You'd have to organize through a professional trade or professional association or geographic affiliation. There were limits on what DOL could do because some of the big concerns about what happens with open MEPs, now PEPs, was what happens if one of the employers doesn't contribute the assets? What happens if, you know, the various obligations aren't met by all the members? Is that a problem for the one member, or does it taint the entire organization? And so Congress in the SECURE Act came through with comprehensive legislation that really addresses all of those problems at once. And so the new pooled employer plan, or PEP, is in addition to existing multiple employer plan options. So it's a new thing. It doesn't replace the variations that have been there before, but it's a new thing added on to that. And with the PEP, you don't have to have any common interest between the employers. You're able to bring together many disparate employers into this organization. And it has, of course, a variety of specific issues to be addressed. So one of the big things that has been changed is this so-called one bad apple relief. You now have a situation, and this is true not just for PEPs but for all existing MEPs, that it's no longer the case that there's just the one company that's tainting the rest. It provides relief for that so that this is across the board and not just with PEPs. But taking a moment specifically, what is a PEP? What is a pooled employer plan? Well, it's an individual account plan with two or more adopting employers, but it's really only for individual account DC plans. It does not include 403Bs, 457Bs, or defined benefit plans. So right off the bat, there are some limitations on what type of plan can be a PEP. In order for a PEP to be a PEP, one of the things it has to have is a PPP, which is the pooled plan provider. So think of it this way. You're looking at a new form of plan that has a professional manager who is the main fiduciary. That's the pooled plan provider's role. The PEP has to have a number of structural issues in place. It has to have, in addition to the PPP, who's the named fiduciary and the 316 administrator for the plan, they have to designate one or more other trustees. They have to have what the statute says are reasonable, diligent, and systematic procedures to ensure timely deferrals, loan repayments, all of the other contributions to the trust. The management of the PEP in terms of investments, either the PPP, the pool provider there, can either do the management directly or they can delegate that to a professional 338 investment manager. And there have to be no unreasonable restrictions, fees, or penalties that would affect an employer from being able to leave or enter the plan. So it has to have some structures in that place. The pooled plan provider, the person or entity that's organizing this, that's serving as the named fiduciary, that is the 316 administrator, has to take on all of those fiduciary roles. They have to register with Treasury and DOL, having acknowledged their status in writing. They have to ensure the proper bonding for the plan. One of the interesting issues there is the role of the employer and the division of the fiduciary responsibilities. The employer who decides to participate in the plan fiduciary at that employer, is going to be responsible for approving and monitoring, so selecting this entity to join, determining that's a prudent decision, and also monitoring and controlling the compensation that goes to the pooled plan provider. So the employer is still retaining some fiduciary responsibility, but by virtue of joining the PPP, or the PEP, the PEP, where the PPP, the entity managing the PEP, they're responsible for all of the other plan administration. This raises some other issues about audit requirements. There's some relief in the bill for small PEPs. There's also the ability of the Department of Labor to issue regulations that would create a short form, Form 5500 filing for the PEP, if it's a PEP for predominantly small employers. DOL has the authority to do that, but it's not mandated. And, of course, there's a question of when would DOL do that if they chose to do so. I think kind of the big picture to point out here is that this is a real change in the marketplace. And it's not clear initially exactly how that's going to affect the marketplace. So I think looking at this, TPAs, investment advisors, record keepers, all of the major service providers are going to have to take a moment and look at this and decide whether participating in this product, so to speak, is something they want to do, determine how they could do it, and also what the ramifications are of not doing it. You know, will this turn out to be a very effective vehicle for small plans to get access to, for example, 401k plans, or will in the marketplace it not turn out to be that? Who are the winners and the losers in the service providers? Those are some big questions that I think are still up in the air and are going to depend on exactly how this program rolls out. A couple of things to point out. There are a lot of unanswered questions that are raised by these new PEPs. And what I mean by that are there's questions about the allocation of fiduciary responsibility. There's a lot of potential questions about prohibited transactions. For example, if the PPP, the entity managing the 316 administrator, the named fiduciary for the PEP, if they elect to do the investment management themselves, investment selection and monitoring, is that going to raise prohibited transaction problems if they have an affiliation with a product provider? At the outset, it would appear that that does raise some questions. Will DOL provide exemptions? Will there be additional guidance on those questions? Those are some answers that we don't have yet. Another thing to remember is that the employer who participates can either select investments or have them selected for them by the PPP and or its delegated 338. So, again, there are options for employers in how these are structured and how they work. If I were to look into a crystal ball, I would say that we will probably see some PEPs coming to market very quickly. But they probably will be the ones that are most clearly within the four corners of the rules as they now sit, and probably some more advanced options in terms of options with more features, different structures, may take a while to develop in the marketplace, both as a function of the need for regulations and guidance, and as a function of people developing the market and learning how to work through it. So just to wrap all that in a summary, this is a big development. It represents a lot of, frankly, opportunities and risks for different people in the marketplace from the service provider side. But the goal that Congress had when they passed it was to really improve the availability and access to plans for participants, for workers. And in particular, the thinking is that this will be a valuable option for small businesses to have in that would be presumably less burdensome and difficult than offering their own individual 401k plans. So that kind of in a summary is where we are, I think, on PEPs. Fred, did you have any thoughts you wanted to throw in on that?
Yeah, Brad, just picking up on where you were, in the old days when we had open MEPs before now, and we did, if for people who recall how it was years ago, and before the DOL issued some guidance that effectively killed them, the sponsors of the open MEPs were mostly small regional companies, maybe third-party administrators, but now I'm hearing that large financial institutions, for example, banks or major mutual fund companies, may be thinking about setting up their own PEPs, which would be a horse of a different color. What are you hearing? What do you think?
Yeah, I've heard that as well, and I think that's why I think there are risks and opportunities here for different service providers. It could be, for example, that an investment advisor is the entity who organizes a PEP to use with respect to their clients. They maybe partner with one of those large financial institutions to do it. Alternatively, a large financial institution might run this all in-house as its own product, so to speak. That obviously presents some issues for how advisors and the product manufacturers might relate. As you mentioned for TPAs, this may be a natural opportunity for TPAs to create PEPs and run them as part of their services, maybe partnering again with an investment advisor or producing TPAs may try to do both of these. There's a lot of different ways this may play out, and I think one of the big unanswered questions this early on is how does the business side of this work? Are the economics such that it makes sense for certain providers to get involved in this and others not? And really, I think it's just too early to say. But I think what you're saying, Fred, is absolutely correct. There's opportunity for a variety of players to structure and start offering PEPs, and it's just not clear yet how that's going to shake out in the marketplace.
Yeah. Okay, with that, let's move on to Gary. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. So with that, let's kind of move on to the lifetime income issues. One of the big things that people have been expressing concern about for some time is what's the liability of a plan sponsor who selects, say, a group annuity in their plan? What's their tail of liability? What happens if the annuity provider isn't able to meet the commitments? How does the plan sponsor know, essentially what their risk is in making those selections? And there's been a feeling by a lot of folks that this has been a deterrent to plans offering annuitization as one of the distribution options. And so one of the issues that was addressed in the past, there was a DOL regulation, which in full disclosure, I should say that I was running the agency when we put it out, that was intended to be a safe harbor for that annuity selection. But I think in practice, it didn't accomplish that job because it was a little too vague. It said things like appropriately consider the solvency of the carrier and so forth. What Congress has done in the SECURE Act is put into legislation a safe harbor that's much more objective, and that is going to make it much easier for plan sponsors to know that they've fallen into the safe harbor. And it allows them to very significantly rely on the representations by the carriers about their solvency. So it solves a couple of problems. It gives some clarity to plan fiduciaries to know that they're in the safe harbor. But secondly, it gives them the ability to rely on those representations and have clear standards as to how to assess those annuity providers when they're selecting them. So that is one big development that I think a lot of folks are at least hoping, depending on who you're talking to, of course, that this is something that might facilitate annuitization and plans. Another aspect of that is Congress put into the SECURE Act a portability requirement so that if your plan stops offering the annuity that you've been involved in as a participant, you'll be able to roll that off into another plan or into an IRA. And that addresses some of the portability concerns that have also been an issue with annuities. And the third big part that the SECURE Act does is that it requires that at least annually, the participant's statement includes a projection of their lifetime income in their plans based on essentially how they're doing currently. That is going to require a regulation from the Labor Department. They've given the department 12 months to come up with an interim final rule. That is going to be quite a challenge for the Labor Department to do for a couple of reasons. One, that's actually a very technically difficult regulation to write. And just to give you a quick flavor for that, if you have a person who's 25 years old with $5,000 in their 401k account, are you going to give a projection based on their $5,000 as if they were 65 today and say, you know, lucky you, you just got a $12 annuity, which might be a disincentive to the value of the plan as well as not useful information? Alternatively, are they going to say, well, here's how you can project forward that $5,000 balance in contributions for 40 years, then come up with a number on which to base an annuity? And obviously that's very speculative and raises a lot of issues about the assumptions and what are the right ways, the right methodology to use to do that. Compounding that is the fact that there are a lot of service providers who do a similar function already in providing that kind of estimate. So DOL has to contend with the technical difficulties of what's the right way to do it and also whether putting in place one way actually chills the development in the marketplace of better ways. All of that presents some very difficult issues for DOL to chew on, which in fact the agency has looked at in the past when they issued a request for information around 2010 or 11, somewhere in there, and started to look at these issues. And effectively, and this isn't how they would characterize it, but it's how I would characterize it watching them, effectively they decided it was too hard to solve and didn't finish that rulemaking. But they're going to have to now. The other complicating factor, and this is true of all these regulations, is that, of course, we have the presidential election coming up here in November. So the SECURE Act is coming out at a time where we could potentially change administrations. Certainly, it creates issues about the regulatory agenda and priorities as to what the Trump administration wants to finish in its current term. And all of that is going to raise some real difficulties, especially if there is a change in the presidential administration, as to how to meet those deadlines, what the regulatory priorities are, and the policy that may underline some of those decisions as well. So to the extent we're waiting on regulations, whether it's from Labor, Treasury, or wherever else, there's a lot of uncertainty built into that too. Now, the flip side of that, and Fred, I think this is important to remind people, a lot of these provisions take effect this year. So a lot of these provisions are already in effect. So we're going to see a lot of people having to develop good faith compliance processes based on the statute, which we'll see how those are later affected by regulatory and guidance decisions that might come out from agencies. So the SECURE Act offers a lot of new things that we're going to have to adjust to, some of them very quickly, but is probably going to present a conundrum for the regulators to give timely guidance that we're all looking for.
Brad, let's go back to the safe harbor for picking guaranteed income products. The safe harbor extends to the financial strength of the insurance company, but then there's another provision that says, but the fiduciary still has to decide whether or not the cost of the product is reasonable. That makes me think that we're probably going to be looking at institutional products because retail products might be 50 or 100% higher, more expensive. What do you think about that provision and what the impact will be?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, Fred. Nothing in this is absolving the fiduciary of their fiduciary responsibility to prudently select their service providers. So they're going to have to take into account all of those relevant factors. You know, I mentioned solvency and the issue there, but as you say, they're going to have to take into account fees, all of the other features that go into, is this something we want to include in our plan? And if so, which products from which carrier? So there's a lot of analysis that has to go into that. And I think you're right. One of the big issues there is going to be fees. And as you say, there's quite a difference between an individual and a group-based product in that respect. And that may also be an issue that comes up in this portability factor. You know, if I'm rolling over into an IRA, what are some of the deals, what are some of the details they're going to have to go into how to handle that kind of rollover where you might be leaving a group product going into the IRA?
Yeah, so I guess this is part of a series, like at the Saturday matinee, where every session we're going to be talking about you're peeling the next level off the onion. But I think it's a good change. I think both MEPs, open MEPs called PEPs, and guaranteed income and plans properly done are positive. I just want to bounce it off you and see if you've had the same reaction.
Yeah, no, I do think that's true. I think there are a lot of positive changes here. It's making opportunities more available to plans across a variety of fronts. And again, for service providers, that's going to present both opportunities and challenges. So in that sense, the Secure Act really has made a lot of changes that I think were intended to, and in many ways will be positive, but it also means we're entering a period of uncertainty, both in terms of how it's going to work as a business matter, as a marketplace issue, but also with regulatory and guidance issues. So as you say, we'll be spending a lot of time on this over the next couple of years, and every few months we'll have sort of a new I like your analogy to the onion. You know, so right now we're dealing with that first outer layer, making sure we understand what's going on, when it applies, and starting to develop answers. But the next layer of the onion is going to get into the new problems that emerge based on what we're doing currently. And so that's just going to be an ongoing process. Now, again, I mentioned before, there's a lot of other provisions in the Secure Act, which we aren't going to go into. But there are a number of other plan provisions that are relevant, but many of which are off in the future. A couple of ones that are immediate is, you know, there's some tax benefits to employers starting plans, to using automatic enrollment in plans. So there's some tax credits there. There's some improvements in the timing on when you could start a plan, making that extend much longer, giving flexibility to employers to start plans. But I think what's long-term going to be an issue, but fortunately is long-term, is this question of regular part-time employees. Fortunately, you have about 2 to 3 years before we actually have to implement that provision. But what it says is that if you have certain employees who are part-time 500 or more hour employees who would otherwise not be eligible, but who did 500 or more hours in each of the last 3 years, they would now need to be eligible for the plan. There's also a provision for employees who work more than 1,000 hours. Fortunately, again, that doesn't take effect until a couple of years from now, because that's going to require record keepers, payroll providers, TPAs. Everyone's going to have to do some change in how they collect data about employees to deal with the fact that these are normally folks who have not been eligible in the past, and it's going to require some pretty basic level changes to their systems to get the data necessary to comply. So there's a lot in here that we'll be talking about for a number of years.
That's great, Brad. Thank you so much. Let's segue right over to Jim Lundy. Jim, you know, there's an SEC sweep program going on examining sales and revenue sharing and administrators for 403B plans for teachers. The SEC included a reference, actually two references to teachers in their 2020 examination priorities. So can you fill us in with what's going on there and any observations you might have about it?
Sure. Thanks, Fred. And as you said, there is a sweep going on in this area. The sweep is being led by the Enforcement Division. Initially, there was some thought that perhaps OC was involved, but it very much appears to be, at this point, being driven by the Division of Enforcement. And when you back up and look at how this evolved, the SEC has been fairly open about their effort in this space. And timing-wise, it appears to be the next phase of the SEC's continuing efforts to focus in on Main Street issues as some of the matters related to the share class selection disclosure initiative are resolving. There's already been one the first and second wave of that. So this appears to be the next area of focus. And when you back up to the summer, again, and you start to put all this together with hindsight, the SEC has been fairly open about the prioritization in this area. And in particular, there was an announcement and some statements by the chairman in which he talked openly about what he called the Teachers Initiative, and that initiative would be led in part by the Enforcement Division's Retail Strategy Task Force. And that task force, while not considered a quote-unquote specialty unit of the Division of Enforcement, very much operates like a specialty unit. And most specialty units, as we now know from the work of the Asset Management Specialty Unit and the Self-Reporting Initiative, have some increased knowledge in particular areas and increased incentive to be creative in trying to bring cases in particular areas that are a priority for the commission, and under this chairman, as I said, Main Street issues are his main priority. And then when you fast forward, as information started to become more available in the public domain last fall, co-director Stephanie Avakian gave a speech that covered a variety of topics, including this topic, and was pretty open about the issues that enforcement is reviewing. And in particular, she said they were looking at the compensation and practices of the third-party administrators operating in this space regarding teacher retirement plans, as well as the practices of affiliated advisors and broker-dealers who worked with them, and that they were looking into how the investment options were being chosen, how compensation was working, and not surprisingly, how that compensation related to potential financial incentive conflicts of interest and the related disclosures or the lack thereof. And as things continue to evolve in the fall, due to some very good coverage in the financial press and by some of the firms who follow this, including Fred, some of the work you and I did in putting out a blog in this space, there was some information revealed about what, in fact, enforcement is looking at with a little more specificity than we typically see, because SEC enforcement investigations, as the vast majority of us know, are non-public. And what came to light a little more specifically was that these enforcement suite document requests involved requests for documents on compensation that the administrators received since January 1st regarding referring specific investment options. The documents and information related to any gifts or any other type of non-monetary compensation received from administrators and firms that work in this space, documents related to how the administrators provide investment counseling to investors, and things like organizational charts and other things revealing ties between administrators and the firms who operate in this space. At or around that same time, Fred, it also came to light that a particular firm that was under investigation publicly acknowledged that they were one of the entities under investigation, and it appears that that particular investigation, and again, I'm surmising this, may have been in place prior to this initiative, but the issues are very much related, and it appears that in that investigation, in addition to conflicts and disclosure issues, the investigation also involved whether or not there were payments akin to what I would describe as pay-to-play that may have involved covering school district expenses and things of that nature. For that particular firm, there has been no public filing regarding an enforcement action yet, but it appears to involve some serious issues, as the public coverage of that matter indicated that several high-level executives of the firm had been placed on administrative leave. And the states are also active in this space, Fred. As you and I know, the New York Department of Financial Services has investigations open in this area. And more recently, the Delaware Attorney General's Office settled a matter regarding a 403B provider that was providing services to educators in their state and under their jurisdiction. And in that matter, they charged the registered representative involved and also, charge the firm with failure to supervise. So, obviously, I think as most of us know, the ability to control particular registered representatives from time to time in those rare circumstances where someone goes somewhat rogue can be difficult to manage, particularly in large organizations. And based on some of the facts alleged by Delaware, that may have been the case in that particular matter. But the firm, while it was publicly acknowledged, was fully cooperative, nevertheless was charged with failure to supervise. So from a firm perspective, when these matters come out, there's a consistent message that always weaves across whatever enforcement matter comes out when you see failure to supervise. And that message is, for the firms who are involved in this space, you know, hopefully you have not yet received a communication from the enforcement division indicating that you've been subjected to this industry sweep-wide effort. And if you have not, you're in the advantageous position to proactively do an assessment of what your supervisory policies, procedures, and practices are so that you can make sure that you have the right policies, procedures, and practices in place so that the firm is protected. And oftentimes during those types of exercises, what will be revealed is if there are weaknesses, that can ferret out where there may be reps who may be pushing the envelope such that they can be reined in, placed on supervision, given training to minimize the risk that a particular rep may create exposure for the firm. So that's pretty much where things stand currently, Fred. I expect there to be more to come. This does not appear to be as coordinated as the self-reporting initiative where we're going to see releases involving clumped together waves of cases. We may see that. But oftentimes when there is a sweep effort, again, because it is non-public, what you tend to see is two or three matters, four or five matters coming out in a relatively close period of time. So I think we should keep our eyes open for that. And oftentimes nowadays, with the message efforts that enforcement has, in reviewing those cases, we should be able to pick up additional educational pieces of information for ways for firms to improve their practices in this area. Now, that's my view. They may collectively release a batch of cases together, you know, with a statement by the chairman or by a director. They may do that. I don't know. But regardless of how the next wave of enforcement efforts in this space comes out, it's worth firms who have practices in this area to pay close attention to.
Jim, just to summarize, and tell me if I got it right, but the moral of the story, if we just look at what we know today, is one, the focus is on 403B sales to teachers. Two, they're looking at the flow of money and whether or not disclosures are being properly made. Three, the focus is primarily on broker-dealers and affiliated entities and administrators of 403B plans. And number four, and perhaps most importantly, that the firms should look at their supervisory procedures to make sure that they've got the right processes in place and they're implementing them properly in case the SEC comes knocking at their door. Is that about it?
Yeah, Fred, I'd like to just make one slight point. You had mentioned the focus is on broker-dealers. That's correct, but, you know, broker-dealers, I think, operate a lot in this space, perhaps comparatively slightly more so than registered investment advisors. But registered investment advisors operate in this space as well. So unlike the initiative, which was very focused on the one particular side of the industry, the investment advisory side, as opposed to broker-dealers, this sweep effort seems to be focused in both areas.
Oh, okay. Thanks. Sandra, we're moving over to you here. You and I have talked, Sandy, and Mike's about the preparedness of broker-dealers for compliance with Reg BI on June 30th. And my experience is that a lot of the people I'm talking to are behind the curve in terms of having everything prepared to be fully implemented on June 30th. But that's just my experience. Why don't you take us beyond that and let us know what others are saying and what's going on?
So thank you, Fred. So absolutely, Reg BI, which was passed in June 2019, becomes enforceable on June 30th, 2020. We're in the final stretch. This is the end of June. So literally we have 5 months from now until enforcement of the reg will be started. And FINRA and SEC have been giving us resources to say, here is what you can do to get ready. FINRA's priority letter this year just came out last month. That was its 2020 Risk Monitoring Exam Priority Letter. And in the letter, it explains that for the first half of this year, 2020, it will be reviewing the firm's preparedness for Reg BI to gain an understanding of implementation challenges that they face. But by the second half, in coordination with the SEC, it will be examining firms. And while it says the intention is to coordinate efforts so there's not duplicative examinations, they're very firm on the fact that they'll be examining for compliance of Reg BI. And they've been repeatedly saying throughout the last 7 months that they're not looking to have gotcha moments. Rather, they're looking to make sure that there was a good faith effort by firms to comply with the rule. And they have also repeatedly said that when, in order to really satisfy that compliance issue, you have to comply with the four portions of the rule. And as you probably know by now, those portions are care, disclosure, conflict of interest, and compliance. And failure in any one of the four is failure in is a violation of the rule in total. So what would I suggest that we do to get ready by now? Presumably, everybody has already established their expert team. Depending upon your size, you probably have one expert or a team of experts who've had an opportunity to look through the close to 1,000 pages of Reg BI and its interpretation by the SEC and form CRS. And if you haven't done so, this would absolutely be the time to do that. Both FINRA and the SEC have made resources available to firms to look at, review, and to ask questions about. So there's a FAQ on best interest by the SEC. There's also an FAQ on form CRS. The SEC has published a small entity compliance guide. It's also published interpretations regarding the solely incidental prong of the broker-dealer exclusion from the definition of investment advisors, all, you know, in addition to just their interpretation of the CRS and Reg BI, all of which are really helpful. They've given us a website, which is iabdquestions@sec.gov, where you can submit questions to them. FINRA has been hosting in-person meetings that have been educational events. The last one was January 8th, 2020. To the extent you can attend one of those, I would highly recommend them. But also FINRA summarizes them on their website, which is finra.org, including little snippets of videos of the panelists who are both SEC and FINRA experts and enforcement officials, so you have a sense of what FINRA is doing. But more importantly, in the priority letter, FINRA tells you what it's going to examine for. And it sets forth 10 things that it has as the possible examination subjects for the latter part of 2020. So think of this sort of like an open book test where the professor has given you the questions that that you're going to be facing. But if you're like me, I'm a real list person. I love lists. It gives me the opportunity to check off when I've accomplished something. And so I'm encouraged by the fact that there is also a checklist that FINRA provides. And in the checklist are a list of 20 items. And you'll see that 10 of those items are repeated in the priority letter. They're exactly the same items. So not only do you know what they're going to examine, you know what FINRA is expecting you to do, because in their checklist, they give you like little hints. So the checklist tells you how the new rule is similar to and different from the old suitability rule. It also gives you, so for instance, you'll have it'll say that it'll tell you that procedures and training has to be in place to access the best interest standard, and the change from FINRA suitability rule is the best interest requirement. and there has to be an overreaching obligation which satisfies that component of it. But it'll also tell you that you don't have to agree to monitor an account. But once you agree to monitor the account, you take on the responsibility of monitoring the account. On the other hand, you can voluntarily review accounts, and that's not considered monitoring as long as there's not an agreement to monitor. And so that would not necessarily create an implied agreement with the customer to monitor the account. So there's lots of little, like, hints as to what you can and cannot do, and that's true for all 20. There are some things there where FINRA tells you that while it's not a rule, it's the best practice. So I would say focus on the 10 things in the priority letter, but really do take a look at the checklist. For example, one of the items are consider how to ensure high-risk and complex products are in the retail's best interest, and then FINRA goes on to say, although it's not a rule requirement, DB should consider it as a best practice applying heightened scrutiny as to whether high-risk complex investments such as inverse or leveraged ETFs are in the retail customer's best interest. So you have sort of where FINRA is going to go in its exam, and this is the opportunity for you to take advantage of that. And I can't stress the fact that they're giving you a lot of sort of ways to get ready, and they're also giving you sort of hints. So, for instance, they say if you decide to use an expert and buy an off-the-shelf product, make sure that that product is specialized or itemized or customized for your particular practice. And they've said repeatedly that they don't expect the largest of firms and the smallest of firms to have the same profile on compliance. It's going to be specific to your business. So when you get your team together and when you start looking at these checklists, you have to really be specific as to what is best for your customers. And to the extent that you're hiring experts to help you fulfill that purpose, that you've actually itemized them or customized them so they're best fitted for your particular business facts. Anything else I can say on that, Fred, that I haven't covered?
Yeah, I have one question. Sandy, at one point in your career, you were an in-house attorney at a large broker-dealer. The SEC says that it's elevating cost as one of the considerations under the duty of care or the care obligation. And, in fact, they go on to list cost as one of the four things that have to be considered in the development of every recommendation made by a broker-dealer beginning June 30. But it doesn't have to be the lowest cost, but it has to be one of the factors to be considered, and obviously given some significant weight, or they wouldn't have listed it above the others. How will a broker-dealer actually go about building processes where no matter whether you're recommending third-party asset managers or annuities or mutual funds or stocks and bonds, you're somehow taking cost into account? What do you think that's going to look like going forward?
Well, first of all, they definitely should have some written supervisory procedure that addresses the fact that they're going to be reviewing costs. And, Fred, you're right. While cost is always to be considered in making a recommendation, it doesn't mean that it's dispositive in the making of the recommendation. And this is, in fact, a new basis. Cost was not previously an element in the suitability standard. So now we're at the point where we're going to have to expressly make that one of the considerations for retail customers. And I think that, you know, there have been other challenges in terms of things like excessive trading about how a firm is going to review that. And monitoring, I think, would probably be the best way of doing that. They have some uniform rules about what is to be considered and some evidentiary proof that it was one of the elements considered. So it doesn't have to be the lowest cost, but it has to be within the consideration. So I don't think that the firm has to go about finding the lowest product for every client? Are we going to get rid of mutual funds and only suggest ETFs because that's technically lower cost than the mutual funds? Or can we just consider whether for this particular client, a mutual fund really is the better product? And so I think it's a little bit more complicated than just reaching for the lowest cost fruit. It has to be specific to that particular client, but there has to be a way to sort of itemize what you looked at and why you came to the conclusion that the product is appropriate for this client, even though it's not the lowest cost. And so those procedures may differ from the big firm to the small firm, but I do think that the firm has to look at the kind of clientele it has, the kind of products that it's offering, and come up with a strategy for determining that, one, that product is in the best interest of a client, and coming to that conclusion among the elements that were considered was cost of the product.
Yeah, thank you. You know, this is going to be interesting. I think in each of the, maybe even in our next call, Sandy, we could identify a couple of areas like cost and mitigation and some of the others and talk about what we're hearing from our clients, about what they're doing about them, because I see, now that I've gotten to know these rules well, Reg BI and the other rules, this is much more demanding than I initially thought it was. And the practical application is more demanding. So maybe we get down in the weeds. But I think that might help people.
Well, you know, and if the problem is not solvable in the next 6 months, I think I would suggest that what our clients or what our friends do is make sure they document that they've reviewed the problem and they've thought about how to solve it and they've implemented what they can to get to the end. But, because remember, good faith is going to be the standard, and it's very difficult to prove good faith unless you have some documentation of your efforts.
Good advice. Thanks. Hey, Eduardo, let's open it up to calls.
Yes, of course. So if you'd like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on the phone line will indicate when your line is open, and please state your name before posing a question. Again, star 1 to ask a question. Please go ahead.
Yeah, Brad, while we're waiting to see if people call in with questions, one question that we got before the call was, could we comment on what's happening with the Department of Labor and the re-proposed fiduciary regulation that we keep hearing about? What do you know about that?
Yeah, unfortunately, we don't know much about that. The DOL fiduciary rule round 2 is something the department is still saying that they're going to be putting out, could be coming out at any time, but they've been saying that now for a number of months, and it hasn't come out yet. I just today checked the web page where you can see where regulations go from the agency to the White House for review formally, and that hasn't happened yet. So, you know, one consideration there is, you know, we still don't know what the policy that re-proposed regulation will be. We assume it'll have a new class action exemption along the lines of something that would be consistent with where the SEC is going with Reg BI. And we think it's possible it may still do some changes on the definition of fiduciary with respect to rollover advice. But we don't know the answers to that, and we're all waiting to see. And, of course, there is the reality that, you know, the clock is ticking on what you can get done on a regulatory matter as you approach the end of a current term of a presidential administration. So we'll all keep watching and see what happens.
Operator?
Yes, and once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. We'll wait for a moment for everyone to get an opportunity to submit for questions.
Okay, Brad, let me come back to you with another question. Associated with the DOL fiduciary rule is a prohibited transaction exemption. Because if the feeling is that the new rule will allow perhaps transactional compensation, but that will be prohibited absent an exemption. What are you thinking about that? Right now we have that non-enforcement policy for non-discretionary investment advice. But what do you think is happening there?
Yeah, that's worth reviewing quickly. With the Fifth Circuit vacating the DOL fiduciary rule, it also vacated with it the various exemptions, and that included the best interest contract exemption, or BIC exemption, or BICE, depending on which acronym you preferred. The utility of that exemption is it did permit transaction-based compensation, and it was used for a lot of other things as well. As you say, it was a vehicle to address compensation where there was non-discretionary investment advice, and also in rollover transactions. And so when that was vacated, DOL put out this temporary enforcement policy that we're still under, which says that if you follow the key elements of the BIC exemption as if they were still valid, then DOL and the IRS won't pursue a prohibited transaction against you. And while that's a good stopgap, what we really need is a replacement for the BIC exemption to address, again, a whole host of those issues, from rollovers to other forms of transaction-based compensation. And DOL, presumably, is that's what's going to be part of this new round two fiduciary rule, is such a class exemption. Because of the way they filed it in the paperwork on the regulatory agenda, it's coming through the Office of the Exemption Determinations, the subdivision of the Employee Benefit Security Administration that does exemption writing. So that's what we think is going to happen, and we think one of their goals is to make, as I said before, the compliance with SEC regulations and rules be very close to the conditions of the exemption. Maybe not identical, but close enough that you would have a more simplified compliance process. But as we haven't seen it come out, we don't know that for sure, so we're all still sort of speculating.
Operator?
Yes, we'll now take our first question. Please go ahead, caller.
Yeah, hi guys. Thanks for the seminar. Thanks for the information. It's great. I just have a question. I just heard you mention real briefly on the PEPs that a 316 fiduciary must register. Did you say register with the DOL, or the IRS, or the SEC? Can you just enlighten me a little bit on that? I'm a TTA considering a PEP.
Sure. So if you're going to do a PEP, the PEP has to have the pooled plan provider, the PPP, who's the named fiduciary and the 316 administrator for the plan. And one of the requirements of being a PPP is that you have to acknowledge that in writing, and you have to register with both Treasury and the Labor Department. Now, at Treasury, will that be delegated to the IRS? You know, yeah, those are some details that will probably find out more in the course of time. But, yeah, it does require that registration so that those agencies will know who's acting in that capacity and, therefore, who's the fiduciary responsible for the PEP, the Pooled Employer Plan.
Is there a form for the registration? Is that like a form for from the Department of Labor? Or, I mean, is there even a process for that?
I suspect there will be. I am not aware that they've yet put out a process for that, but I have to confess I haven't looked at that yet either. I haven't yet had someone who needed to register. But my guess is that, yes, they will make that fairly straightforward and not overly difficult, if I'm not being too optimistic. But I suspect they will say, you know, here's a form you need to file, or you need to send a notice to this address electronically or postal.
Yeah. And the PEPs don't kick in until 2021, right?
No, that's not the case. They kick in, Fred, check me on this, but I believe that provision starts this year.
Yeah, I believe so too.
Okay,
yeah, I think the only significant thing that's delayed until 2021 or 2022 even really are the part-time employees. Many of these provisions take effect already.
Yeah. All right, great. Thank you.
Yeah, I think the classic structure, what we'll see a PEP look like, is there will be this PPP, the pool plan provider. The pool plan provider may be a record keeper already. If not, they'll need to contract with a record keeper and a TPA for record keeping and compliance services. I think the PPP will hire a 338 investment manager to select the lineup, and I think the PPP will hire a bank trustee or a trust company to hold the assets as the trustee of the plan. So there's going to be multiple moving pieces, but at the heart of a PEP is a PPP. So you've got to get all your designations right all your acronyms right to understand this. But Brad, do you agree that that's more or less what most of them will look like?
Yeah, I think that's as I said before, I think there are a lot of different ways this could be structured, but that more that what you're describing is probably the easiest, fastest way forward. And I think we'll see more complexity and variation as some of the other legal questions get answered by guidance and regulations. But what you're describing sounds to me like kind of the way we're going to see the early adopters go.
Yeah. Operator?
Yes, and once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press star 1. We'll now take our next question. Please go ahead, caller.
Hey, Jim Lundy, while we're waiting for the last question, if there is one,
Hi.
You know,
hi.
Brett,
yes,
we do have a question on the line.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
So with respect to the delay of the new fiduciary rule and any corresponding PTEs, do we have a sense that something could issue in 2020, or do we know why there's been a delay?
Well, we don't know for certain why there's been a delay, but obviously one of the big changes that's occurred as this has been debated is that the Secretary of Labor changed from Secretary Acosta to Secretary Scalia. And obviously Secretary Scalia has a significant background in this issue, having been the lead counsel for the various trade associations who succeeded in the Fifth Circuit in having the rule vacated. So initially we were having a delay while ethics officials determined whether he could work on this issue. They concluded that he could, and that happened several months ago. So what we don't know is the delay related to his review and policy decisions and changes there? Is it some other factor? There could be quite a few reasons for that. In terms of timing, you know, as I said, the longer they delay, the harder it is to get something out. One of the considerations as you approach the end of the first term of an administration is whether it's going to be the first term or the only term. And a subsequent administration that's different, the closer a regulation is to the end of that term, there's several different mechanisms for that regulation to be struck down. So it's in there, well, struck down is the wrong term, to be either put down by Congress or changed by the incoming administration through several different avenues. So it's in their interest to move this expeditiously. That said, it's going to be a very tall order if they sent the regulation to the White House for review tomorrow, and if the White House took a very short turnaround time of just several weeks, you'd probably still have, you know, probably a 60-day comment period. Maybe you could shorten that to 30, but that would expose you to some risk under the Administrative Procedure Act and the other rules governing that process. So then you'd have, you know, that'd put you out a couple of months. Then you'd have to, you know, finalize your response to that, get that through the White House, get it approved, and then published. It's possible they could do all that in 2020, but it would be a very aggressive schedule for an agency to keep. So, you know, the longer we delay, the less likely it is it gets done in 2020, but it's not impossible.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Brad. Yeah, thanks, Brad, and Sandy, and Jim Lundy. But Jim Dolan, it's time for me to turn it over to you. Do you want to bring us to a close and let us know what's happening next?
Happy to, Fred. Thanks so much. Fantastic call, as always. Again, thank you, everyone, for calling in today. Please mark your calendar. I believe it is the 32nd Inside the Beltway, April 23rd. So, again, thanks so much for the great call. And with that, Eduardo, please close it out for us.
Yes, this now concludes today's call. Thank you for your participation.